This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, A New History of a Lost World, by Steve Brusati, read by Patrick Lawler. Prologue, The Golden Age of Discovery. A few hours before light broke on a cold November morning in 2014, I got out of a taxi and pushed my way into Beijing's Central Railway Station. I clutched my ticket as I fought through a swarm of thousands of early morning commuters, my nerves starting to jangle as the departure time for my train ticked ever closer. I had no idea where to go. Alone with only a few words of Chinese in my vocabulary, all I could do was try to match the pictographic characters on my ticket to the symbols on the platforms. Tunnel vision set in, and I barreled up and down the escalators, past the newsstands and noodle joints like a predator on the hunt. My suitcase, weighed down with cameras, a tripod, and other scientific gear, bounced along behind me, rolling over feet and smacking into shins. Angry shouts seemed to come at me from all directions, but I didn't stop. By now, sweat was pouring through my downy winter jacket, and I was gasping in the diesel haze. An engine roared to life somewhere ahead of me, and a whistle sounded. A train was about to depart. I staggered down the concrete steps leading to the tracks and, to my great relief, recognized the symbols. Finally, this was my train, the one that would be shooting northeastward to Jinzhou, a Chicago-sized city in old Manchuria, a few hundred miles from the frontier with North Korea. For the next 4 hours, I tried to get comfortable as we crawled past concrete factories and hazy cornfields. Occasionally, I nodded off, but I couldn't steal back much sleep. I was far too excited. A mystery was waiting at the end of the journey, a fossil that a farmer stumbled upon while harvesting his crops. I had seen a few grainy photos sent to me by my good friend and colleague Jun Chong Lu, one of China's most famous dinosaur hunters. We both agreed it looked important. Maybe even one of those Holy Grail fossils, a new species preserved in such an immaculate way that we can sense what it was like as a living, breathing creature tens of millions of years in the past. But we needed to see it ourselves to be sure. When Jun Chong and I stepped off the train in Jinzhou, we were greeted by a band of local dignitaries who took our bags and ushered us into two black SUVs. We were whizzed off to the city's museum, a surprisingly nondescript building on the outskirts of town. With the seriousness of a high-level political summit, we were led through the flickering neon lights of a long hallway into a side room with a couple of desks and chairs. Balanced on a small table was a slab of rock so heavy that it seemed the legs were starting to buckle. One of the locals spoke in Chinese to Jun Chong, who then turned to me and gave a quick nod. "Let's go," he said in his curiously accented English, a combination of the Chinese cadence he grew up with and the Texas drawl that he picked up as a grad student in America. The two of us came together and stepped toward the table. I could feel the eyes of everyone, an eerie silence hanging over the room as we approached the treasure. Before me was one of the most beautiful fossils I had ever seen. It was a skeleton, about the size of a mule, its chocolate-brown bones standing out from the dull gray limestone surrounding it. A dinosaur for sure. Its steak knife teeth, pointy claws, and long tail leaving no doubt that it was a close cousin of Jurassic Park's villainous Velociraptor. But this was no ordinary dinosaur. Its bones were light and hollow, its legs long and skinny like a heron's, its slender skeleton the hallmark of an active, dynamic, fast-moving animal. And not only were there bones, but there were feathers covering the entire body. bushy feathers that looked like hair on the head and neck, long branching feathers on the tail, and big quill pens on the arms, lined together and layered over each other to form wings. This dinosaur looked just like a bird. About a year later, Junchong and I described this skeleton as a new species, which we called Zhenyuanlong Suni. It is one of about 15 new dinosaurs that I've identified over the past decade, as I've carved out a career in paleontology that has taken me from my roots in the American Midwest to a faculty job in Scotland, with many stops all over the world to find and study dinosaurs. Zhenyuanlong is unlike the dinosaurs I learned about in elementary school before I became a scientist. I was taught that dinosaurs were big, scaly, stupid brutes so ill-equipped for their environment that they just lumbered around, biding their time, waiting to go extinct. Evolutionary failures. Dead ends in the history of life. Primitive beasts that came and went long before humans came on the scene in a primeval world that was so different from today that it may as well have been an alien planet. Dinosaurs were curiosities to see in museums, or movie monsters that haunted our nightmares, or objects of childhood fascination, pretty much irrelevant to us today and unworthy of any serious study. But these stereotypes are absurdly wrong. They've been dismantled over the past few decades as a new generation has collected dinosaur fossils at an unprecedented rate. Somewhere around the world, from the deserts of Argentina to the frozen wastelands of Alaska, a new species of dinosaur is currently being found, on average, once a week. Let that sink in. A new dinosaur every single week. That's about 50 new species each year, Zhenyuanlong among them. And it's not only new discoveries, but also novel ways of studying them, emerging technologies that help paleontologists understand the biology and evolution of dinosaurs in ways that our elders would have found unimaginable. CAT scanners are being used to study dinosaur brains and senses. Computer models tell us how they moved, and high-power microscopes can even reveal what color some of them were, and so on. It's been my great privilege to be part of this excitement, as one of many young paleontologists from across the globe, men and women from many backgrounds who came of age in the era of Jurassic Park. There are a whole bunch of us 20 and 30-something researchers working together and with our mentors from the preceding generation. With each new discovery we make, each new study, we learn a little more about dinosaurs and their evolutionary story. That is the tale I am going to tell in this book. The epic account of where dinosaurs came from, how they rose to dominance, how some of them became colossal and others developed feathers and wings and turned into birds, and then how the rest of them disappeared, ultimately paving the way for the modern world and for us. In doing so, I want to convey how we've pieced together this story using the fossil clues that we have and give some sense of what it's like to be a paleontologist whose job it is to hunt for dinosaurs. Most of all, though, I want to show that dinosaurs were not aliens, nor were they failures, and they're certainly not irrelevant. They were remarkably successful, thriving for over 150 million years and producing some of the most amazing animals that have ever lived, including birds, some 10,000 species of modern-day dinosaurs. Their home was our home, the same Earth, subject to the same whims of climate and environmental change that we have to deal with, or perhaps will deal with in the future. They evolved in concert with an ever-changing world, one subject to monstrous volcanic eruptions and asteroid impacts, and one in which the continents were moving around, sea levels were constantly fluctuating, and temperatures were capriciously rising and falling. They became supremely well-adapted to their environments, but in the end, most of them went extinct when they couldn't cope with a sudden crisis. No doubt there is a lesson there for us. More than anything, the rise and fall of the dinosaurs is an incredible story of a time when giant beasts and other fantastic creatures made the world their own. They walked on the very ground below us, their fossils now entombed in rock, the clues that tell this story. To me, it's one of the greatest narratives in the history of our planet. Steve Brusati, Edinburgh, Scotland, May 18th, 2017. 1. The Dawn of the Dinosaurs. "Bingo!" my friend Gregor's Nidziki shouted, pointing at a knife-thin separation between a slim strip of mudstone and a thicker layer of coarser rock right above it. The quarry we were exploring, near the tiny Polish village of Zachelmi, was once a source of sought-after limestone, but had long been abandoned. The surrounding landscape was littered with decaying smokestacks and other remnants of central Poland's industrial past. The maps deceitfully told us we were in the Holy Cross Mountains, a sad patch of hills once grand, but now nearly flattened by hundreds of millions of years of erosion. The sky was gray, the mosquitoes were biting, heat was bouncing off the quarry floor, and the only other people we saw were a couple of wayward hikers who must have made a tragically wrong turn. "This is the extinction," Gregors said, a big smile creasing the unshaven stubble of many days of fieldwork. "Many footprints of big reptiles and mammal cousins below, but then they disappear, and above we see nothing for a while, and then dinosaurs." We may have been peering at some rocks in an overgrown quarry, but what we were really looking at was a revolution. Rocks record history. They tell stories of deep ancient pasts long before humans walked the earth. And the narrative in front of us, written in stone, was a shocker. That switch in the rocks, detectable perhaps only to the overtrained eyes of a scientist, documents one of the most dramatic moments in Earth history. A brief instance when the world changed, a turning point that happened some 252 million years ago, before us, before woolly mammoths, before the dinosaurs, but one that still reverberates today. If things had unfolded a little differently back then, who knows what the modern world would be like? It's like wondering what might have happened if the Archduke was never shot. If we'd been standing in this same spot 252 million years ago, during a slice of time geologists call the Permian period, our surroundings would have been barely recognizable. No ruined factories or other signs of people. No birds in the sky or mice scurrying at our feet. No flowery shrubs to scratch us up or mosquitoes to feed on our cuts. All of those things would evolve later. We still would have been sweating, though, because it was hot and unbearably humid, probably more insufferable than Miami in the middle of the summer. Raging rivers would have been draining the Holy Cross Mountains, which were actually proper mountains back then, with sharp snowy peaks jutting tens of thousands of feet into the clouds. The rivers wound their way through vast forests of conifer trees, early relatives of today's pines and junipers, emptying into a big basin flanking the hills, dotted with lakes that swelled in the rainy season but dried out when the monsoons ended. These lakes were the lifeblood of the local ecosystem, watering holes that provided an oasis from the harsh heat and wind. All sorts of animals flocked to them. But they weren't animals we would know. There were slimy salamanders bigger than dogs, loitering near the water's edge and occasionally snapping at a passing fish. Stocky beasts called pariasaurs waddled around on all fours. Their knobby skin, front-heavy build, and general brutish appearance making them seem like a mad reptilian offensive lineman. Fat little things called dicynodonts rummaged around in the muck like pigs, using their sharp tusks to pry up tasty roots. Lording over it all were the Gorgonopsians, bear-sized monsters who reigned at the top of the food chain, slicing into pariasaur guts and dicynodont flesh with their saber-like canines. This cast of oddballs ruled the world right before the dinosaurs. Then, deep inside, the earth began to rumble. You wouldn't have been able to feel it on the surface, at least when it kicked off, right around 252 million years ago. It was happening 50, maybe even 100 miles underground, in the mantle, the middle layer of the crust mantle core sandwich of Earth's structure. The mantle is solid rock that is so hot and under such intense pressure that, over long stretches of geological time, it can flow like extra viscous silly putty. In fact, the mantle has currents, just like a river. These currents are what drive the conveyor belt system of plate tectonics, the forces that break the thin outer crust into plates that move relative to each other over time. We wouldn't have mountains or oceans or a habitable surface without the mantle currents. However, every once in a while, one of the currents goes rogue. Hot plumes of liquid rock break free and start snaking their way upward to the surface, eventually bursting out through volcanoes. These are called hotspots. They're rare, but Yellowstone is an example of an active one today. The constant supply of heat from the deep earth is what powers Old Faithful and the other geysers. This same thing was happening at the end of the Permian period, but on a continent-wide scale. A massive hotspot began to form under Siberia. The streams of liquid rock rushed through the mantle into the crust and flooded out from volcanoes. These weren't ordinary volcanoes like the ones we're most used to, the cone-shaped mounds that sit dormant for decades and then occasionally explode with a bunch of ash and lava, like Mount St. Helens or Pinatubo. They wouldn't have erupted with the vigor of those vinegar and baking soda contraptions so many of us made as science fair experiments. No, these volcanoes were nothing more than big cracks in the ground, often miles long, that continuously belched out lava year after year, decade after decade, century after century. The eruptions at the end of the Permian lasted for a few hundred thousand years, perhaps even a few million. There were a few bigger eruptive bursts and quieter periods of slower flow. All in all, they expelled enough lava to drown several million square miles of northern and central Asia. Even today, more than a quarter billion years later, the black basalt rocks that hardened out of this lava cover nearly a million square miles of Siberia, about the same land area as Western Europe. Imagine a continent scorched with lava. It's the apocalyptic disaster of a bad B-movie. Suffice it to say, all of the pariasaurs, dicynodonts, and gorgonopsians living anywhere near the Siberian area code were finished. But it was worse than that. When volcanoes erupt, they don't expel only lava, but also heat, dust, and noxious gases. Unlike lava, these can affect the entire planet. At the end of the Permian, these were the real agents of doom, and they started a cascade of destruction that would last for millions of years and irrevocably change the world in the process. Dust shot into the atmosphere, contaminating the high-altitude air currents and spreading around the world, blocking out the sun and preventing plants from photosynthesizing. The once lush conifer forests died out. Then the pariasaurs and dicynodonts had no plants to eat, and then the gorgonopsians had no meat. Food chains started to collapse. Some of the dust fell back through the atmosphere and combined with water droplets to form acid rain, which exacerbated the worsening situation on the ground. As more plants died, the landscape became barren and unstable, leading to massive erosion as mudslides wiped out entire tracts of rotting forest. This is why the fine mudstones in the Zakhelmi Quarry, a rock type indicative of calm and peaceful environments, suddenly gave way to the coarser boulder-strewn rocks so characteristic of fast-moving currents and corrosive storms. Wildfires raged across the scarred land, making it even more difficult for plants and animals to survive. But those were just the short-term effects, the things that happened within the days, weeks, and months after a particularly large burst of lava spilled through the Siberian fissures. The longer-term effects were even more deadly. Stifling clouds of carbon dioxide were released with the lava. As we know all too well today, carbon dioxide is a potent greenhouse gas which absorbs radiation in the atmosphere and beams it back down to the surface, warming up the Earth. The CO2 spewed out by the Siberian eruptions didn't raise the thermostat by just a few degrees. It caused a runaway greenhouse effect that boiled the planet. But there were other consequences as well. Although a lot of the carbon dioxide went into the atmosphere, much of it also dissolved into the ocean. This causes a chain of chemical reactions that makes the ocean water more acidic, a bad thing, particularly for those sea creatures with easily dissolvable shells. It's why we don't bathe in vinegar. This chain reaction also draws much of the oxygen out of the oceans, another serious problem for anything living in or around water. Descriptions of the doom and gloom could go on for pages, but the point is, the end of the Permian was a very bad time to be alive. It was the biggest episode of mass death in the history of our planet. Somewhere around 90% of all species disappeared. Paleontologists have a special term for an event like this, when huge numbers of plants and animals die out all around the world in a short time. A mass extinction. There have been 5 particularly severe mass extinctions over the past 500 million years. The one 66 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous period, which wiped out the dinosaurs, is surely the most famous. We'll get to that one later. As horrible as the end Cretaceous extinction was, it had nothing on the one at the end of the Permian. That moment of time, 252 million years ago, chronicled in the swift change from mudstone to pebbly rock in the Polish quarry, was the closest that life ever came to being completely obliterated. Then things got better. They always do. Life is resilient, and some species are always able to make it through even the worst catastrophes. The volcanoes erupted for a few million years, and then they stopped as the hot spot lost steam. No longer blighted by lava, dust, and carbon dioxide, ecosystems were gradually able to stabilize. Plants began to grow again, and they diversified. They provided new food for herbivores, which provided meat for carnivores. Food webs reestablished themselves. It took at least 5 million years for this recovery to unfold, and when it did, things were better, but now very different. The previously dominant Gorgonopsians, pariosaurs, and their kin were never to stalk the lakesides of Poland or anywhere else, while the plucky survivors had the whole Earth to themselves. A largely empty world, an uncolonized frontier. The Permian had transitioned into the next interval of geological time, the Triassic, and things would never be the same. Dinosaurs were about to make their entrance. As a young paleontologist, I yearned to understand exactly how the world changed as a result of the end Permian extinction. What died and what survived, and why? How quickly did ecosystems recover? What new types of never-before-imagined creatures emerged from the post-apocalyptic blackness? What aspects of our modern world were first forged in the Permian lavas? There's only one way to start answering these questions. You need to go out and find fossils. If a murder has been committed, a detective begins by studying the body and the crime scene, looking for fingerprints, hair, clothing fibers, or other clues that might tell the story of what unfolded and lead to the culprit. For paleontologists, our clues are fossils. They are the currency of our field, the only records of how long extinct organisms lived and evolved. Fossils are any sign of ancient life, and they come in many forms. The most familiar are bones, teeth, and shells, the hard parts that form the skeleton of an animal. After being buried in sand or mud, these hard bits are gradually replaced by minerals and turned to rock, leaving a fossil. Sometimes soft things like leaves and bacteria can fossilize as well, often by making impressions in the rock. The same is sometimes true of the soft parts of animals, like skin, feathers, or even muscles and internal organs. But to end up with these as fossils, we need to be very lucky. The animal needs to be buried so quickly that these fragile tissues don't have time to decay or get eaten by predators. Everything I describe above is what we call a body fossil, an actual part of a plant or animal that turns into stone. But there is another type, a trace fossil, which records the presence or behavior of an organism or preserves something that an organism produced. The best example is a footprint. Others are burrows, bite marks, coprolites, fossilized dung, and eggs and nests. These can be particularly valuable because they can tell us how extinct animals interacted with each other and their environment, how they moved, what they ate, where they lived, and how they reproduced. The fossils that I'm particularly interested in belong to dinosaurs and the animals that came immediately before them. Dinosaurs lived during three periods of geological history, the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous, which collectively form the Mesozoic era. The Permian period, when that weird and wonderful cast of creatures was frolicking alongside the Polish lakes, came right before the Triassic. We often think of the dinosaurs as ancient, but in fact they're relative newcomers in the history of life. The Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and the first microscopic bacteria evolved a few hundred million years later. For some 2 billion years, it was a bacterial world. There were no plants or animals, nothing that could easily be seen by the naked eye had we been around. Then, sometime around 1.8 billion years ago, these simple cells developed the ability to group together into larger, more complex organisms. A global ice age, which covered nearly the entire planet in glaciers down to the tropics, came and went, and in its aftermath, the first animals got their start. They were simple at first, soft sacks of goo like sponges and jellyfish, until they invented shells and skeletons. Around 540 million years ago, during the Cambrian period, these skeletonized forms exploded in diversity, became extremely abundant, started eating one another, and began forming complex ecosystems in the oceans. Some of these animals formed a skeleton made of bones. These were the first vertebrates, and they looked like flimsy little minnows. But they, too, continued to diversify, and eventually some of them turned their fins into arms, grew fingers and toes, and emerged onto the land about 390 million years ago. These were the first tetrapods, and their descendants include all vertebrates that live on land today. Frogs and salamanders, crocodiles and snakes, and then, later, dinosaurs, and us. We know this story because of fossils, thousands of skeletons and teeth and footprints and eggs found all over the world by generations of paleontologists. We're obsessed with finding fossils and notorious for going to great and sometimes stupid lengths to discover new ones. It could be a limestone pit in Poland, or maybe a bluff behind a Walmart, a dump pile of boulders at a construction site, or the rocky walls of a ripe landfill. If there are fossils to be found, then at least some swashbuckling or stupid paleontologist will brave whatever heat, cold, rain, snow, humidity, dust, wind, bug, stench, or war zone stands in the way. That's why I started going to Poland. I first visited in the summer of 2008, a 24-year-old in between finishing my master's and starting my PhD. I went to study some intriguing new reptile fossils that had been found a few years earlier in Silesia, the sliver of southwestern Poland that for years was fought over by Poles, Germans, and Czechs. The fossils were kept in a museum in Warsaw, treasures of the Polish state. I remember the buzz as I approached the capital's central station on a delayed train from Berlin, night shadows covering the hideous Stalin-era architecture of a city rebuilt from ruins after the war. As I stepped off the train, I scanned the crowd. Somebody was supposed to be there holding a sign with my name. I arranged my visit through a series of formal emails with a very senior Polish professor, who badgered one of his graduate students into meeting me at the station and guiding me to the small guest room where I would stay at the Polish Institute of Paleobiology, just a few stories above where the fossils were kept. I had no idea whom I was looking for, and because the train had been more than an hour late, I figured the student had escaped back to the lab, leaving me on my own to navigate a foreign city in the twilight with the few words of Polish on the glossary page of my guidebook. Just as I was starting to panic, I saw a sheet of white paper flapping in the wind, my name hastily scrawled across it. The man holding it was young, with a close-cropped military hairstyle, his hairline just starting to recede like mine. His eyes were dark, and he was squinting. A thin veneer of stubble covered his face, and he seemed to be a little darker than most of the Poles I knew. Tanned, almost. There was something vaguely sinister about him, but that changed in an instant when he recognized me coming toward him. He broke into a huge smile, grabbed my bag, and gripped my hand firmly. "Welcome to Poland. My name is Gregers. How about some dinner?" We were both tired, I from the long train journey, Gregers from working the whole day describing a new batch of fossil bones that he and his crew of undergraduate assistants had just found in southeastern Poland a few weeks before, hence the field tan he was sporting. But we ended up knocking back several beers and talking for hours about fossils. This guy had the same raw enthusiasm for dinosaurs that I had, and he was full of iconoclastic ideas about what happened after the end Permian extinction. Gregers and I became fast friends. For the rest of that week, we studied Polish fossils together, and then during the following four summers, I came back to Poland to do field work with Gregers, often joined by the third musketeer in our band, the young British paleontologist Richard Butler. During that time, we found a lot of fossils and came up with some new ideas about how dinosaurs got their evolutionary start in those heady days after the end Permian extinction. Over the course of those years, I saw Gregers transition from an eager but still somewhat meek graduate student into one of Poland's leading paleontologists. A few years before turning 30, he discovered, in a different corner of the Zakhelmi Quarry, a trackway left by one of those first fishy creatures to walk out of the water and onto land some 390 million years ago. His discovery was published on the cover of Nature, one of the world's leading scientific journals. He was invited to a special audience with Poland's prime minister and gave a TED talk. His steely face, not his fossil discoveries, him, graced the cover of the Polish version of National Geographic. He had become something of a scientific celebrity. But more than anything else, Gregers enjoyed heading out into nature and looking for fossils. He called himself a field animal, explaining that he loved camping and hacking through brush much more than the genteel ways of Warsaw. He couldn't help it. He grew up around Kielce, the main city of the Holy Cross Mountains region, and started collecting fossils as a child. He developed a particular talent for finding a type that many paleontologists ignore. Trace fossils. Footprints, hand impressions, tail drags, the marks dinosaurs and other animals left when they moved across mud or sand, going about their daily business of hunting, hiding, mating, socializing, feeding, and loitering. He was absolutely enamored of tracks. An animal has only one skeleton, but it can leave millions of footprints, he would often remind me. Like an intelligence operative, he knew all the best places to find them. This was his backyard, after all. It was quite the backyard to grow up in, too, because it turned out that those animal-infested seasonal lakes that covered the area during the Permian and Triassic were perfect environments for preserving tracks. For 4 summers, we indulged Gregers' love of tracks. Richard and I tagged along as he led us to many of his secret sites, which were mostly abandoned quarries, bits of rock poking out of streams, and rubbish piles along the ditches of the many new roads that were being built in the area, where workmen would dump the slabs of stone they cut through when laying asphalt. We found a lot, or rather, Gregers did. Both Richard and I developed an eye for the often small hand and footprints left by lizards, amphibians, and early dinosaur and crocodile relatives, but we could never compete with the master. The thousands of tracks that Gregers found over his 2 decades of collecting, plus the pittance of new ones that Richard and I stumbled upon, ended up telling quite a story. There were many types of tracks belonging to a whole slew of different creatures, and they didn't come from just one moment in time, but from a sequence of tens of millions of years, beginning in the Permian, continuing across the Great Extinction into the Triassic, and even reaching the next stage of geological time, the Jurassic period, which began about 200 million years ago. When the seasonal lakes dried up, they left vast mud flats that animals walked across, leaving their marks. The rivers would continuously bring in new sediment to cover up the mud flats, burying them and turning them to stone. The cycle repeated year after year after year, so there is now layer upon layer upon layer of tracks in the Holy Cross Mountains. For paleontologists, this is a bonanza, an opportunity to see how animals and ecosystems were changing over time, particularly after the cataclysmic end-Permian extinction. Identifying what animals made which particular track is relatively straightforward. You compare the shape of the track to the shape of hands and feet. How many fingers or toes are there? Which ones are longest? Which way do they face? Do only the fingers and toes make an impression, or does the palm of the hand and arch of the foot also leave a mark? Are the left and right tracks really close together, as the trackmaker was walking with its limbs right under its body, or are they far apart, made by a creature with limbs sprawled out to the side? By following this checklist, you can usually figure out which general group of animals left the tracks in question. Pinpointing an exact species is almost impossible, but distinguishing the tracks of reptiles from amphibians or dinosaurs from crocodiles is easy enough. The Permian tracks from the Holy Cross Mountains are a diverse lot, and most were made by amphibians, small reptiles, and early synapsids, progenitors of mammals that are often annoyingly and incorrectly described as mammal-like reptiles, although they are not actually reptiles, in kids' books and museum exhibits. Gorgonopsians and Dicynodonts are two types of these primitive synapsids. By all accounts, these latest Permian ecosystems were strong. There were many varieties of animals, some small and others more than 10 feet long and weighing over a ton, living together, thriving in the arid climate along the seasonal lakes. There are, however, no signs of dinosaur or crocodile tracks in the Permian layers, or even any tracks that look like precursors to these animals. Everything changes at the Permian-Triassic boundary. Following the tracks across the extinction is like reading an arcane book in which a chapter of English follows one written in Sanskrit. The latest Permian and earliest Triassic seem to be two different worlds, which is remarkable because the tracks were all left in the identical place, in the same exact environment and climate. Southern Poland didn't stop being a humid lakeland fed by raging mountain streams as the Permian ticked over into the Triassic. No, it was the animals themselves that changed. I get the creeps when looking at the earliest Triassic tracks. I can sense the long-distant specter of death. There are hardly any tracks at all, just a few small prints here and there, but a lot of burrows jutting deep into the rock. It seems the surface world was annihilated, and whatever creatures inhabited this haunted landscape were hiding underground. Almost all of the tracks belong to small lizards and mammal relatives, probably not much larger than a groundhog. Many of the diverse tracks of the Permian are gone, particularly those made by the larger proto-mammal synapsids, and they never reappear. Things gradually start to improve as you follow the tracks up through time. More track types appear, some of the prints get larger, and burrows become rarer. The world was clearly recovering from the shock of end Permian volcanoes. Then, about 250 million years ago, just a couple of million years after the extinction, a new type of track starts showing up. They're small, just a few centimeters long, about the size of a cat's paw. They are arranged in narrow trackways, the five-fingered handprints positioned in front of the slightly larger footprints, which have three long central toes flanked by a tiny toe on each side. The best place to find them is near a tiny Polish village called Strzysowice, where you can park your car at a bridge, scramble your way through thorns and bramble, and poke around the banks of a narrow stream littered with track-covered rock slabs. Gregers discovered the site when he was young, and proudly took me there once, on a miserable July day of obscene humidity, bugs, rain, and thunder. After a few minutes of hacking through the weeds, we were soaked, my field notebook warping as ink started to run off the pages. The tracks found here go by the scientific name of Prorotodactylus. Gregers wasn't quite sure what to make of them. They were certainly different from the other tracks found alongside them, and all of the tracks from the Permian. But what kind of animal made them? Gregers had a hunch they could have something to do with dinosaurs, because an elderly paleontologist named Hartmut Hobold had reported similar tracks from Germany in the 1960s, and had argued that they were made by early dinosaurs or close cousins. But Gregers wasn't sold on the idea. He had spent most of his young career studying tracks and hadn't spent much time with actual dinosaur skeletons, so it was difficult for him to match the prints to a track maker. That's where I came in. For my master's degree, I constructed a family tree of Triassic reptiles, a genealogy showing how the first dinosaurs were related to the other animals of the time. I spent months in museum collections studying fossil bones, so I knew the anatomy of the first dinosaurs quite well, as did Richard, who wrote a PhD thesis on early dinosaur evolution. The three of us put our heads together to figure out what culprit was responsible for the Proroto-Dactylus tracks, and we did indeed conclude that it was a very dinosaur-like animal. We announced our interpretation in a scientific paper we published in 2010. The clues, of course, are in the details of the tracks. When I look at the Proroto-Dactylus trackways, the first thing that jumps out at me is that they are very narrow. There is only a little bit of space between the left and right tracks in the sequence, just a few centimeters. There's only one way for an animal to make tracks like this, by walking upright with the arms and legs right underneath the body. We walk upright, so when we leave footprints on the beach, the left and right ones are very close together. Same with a horse. Take a look at the pattern of horseshoe impressions left by a galloping horse next time you're on a farm, or wagering a few bucks at the track, and you'll see what I mean. But this style of walking is actually quite rare in the animal kingdom. Salamanders, frogs, and lizards move in a different way. Their arms and legs stick out sideways from the body. They sprawl. That means their trackways are much wider, with big separation between the left and right tracks made by their spread-eagle limbs. The Permian world was dominated by sprawlers. After the extinction, however, one new group of reptiles evolved from these sprawlers, but developed an upright posture, the archosaurs. This was a landmark evolutionary event. Sprawling is all well and good for cold-blooded critters that don't need to move very fast. Tucking your limbs under your body, however, opens up a new world of possibilities. You can run faster, cover greater distances, track down prey with greater ease, and do it all more efficiently, wasting less energy as your columnar limbs move back and forth in an orderly fashion rather than twisting around like those of a sprawler. We may never know exactly why some of these sprawlers started walking upright, but it probably was a consequence of the end Permian extinction. It's easy to imagine how this new getup gave archosaurs an advantage in the post-extinction chaos, when ecosystems were struggling to recover from the volcanic haze, temperatures were unbearably hot, and empty niches abounded, waiting to be filled by whatever mavericks could evolve ways to endure the hellscape. Walking upright, it seems, was one of the ways in which animals recovered, and indeed improved, after the planet was shocked by the volcanic eruptions. Not only did the new upright-walking archosaurs endure, but they thrived. From their humble origins in the traumatic world of the early Triassic, they later diversified into a staggering variety of species. Very early, they split into two major lineages which would grapple with each other in an evolutionary arms race over the remainder of the Triassic. Remarkably, both of these lineages survive today. The first, the Pseudosuchians, later gave rise to crocodiles. As shorthand, they are usually referred to as the crocodile line archosaurs. The second, the Avemetatarsalians, developed into pterosaurs, the flying reptiles often called pterodactyls, dinosaurs, and, by extension, the birds that, as we shall see, descended from the dinosaurs. This group is called the birdline archosaurs. The Proroto-Dactylus tracks from Strisevicha are some of the first signs of archosaurs in the fossil record, traces of the great-great-great-grandmother of this whole menagerie. Exactly what kind of archosaur was Proroto-Dactylus? Some peculiarities in the footprints hold important clues. Only the toes make an impression, not the metatarsal bones that form the arch of the foot. The three central toes are bunched very close together, the two other toes are reduced to nubbins, and the back end of the print is straight and razor sharp. These may seem like anatomical minutiae, and in many ways they are. But as a doctor is able to diagnose a disease from its symptoms, I can recognize these features as hallmarks of dinosaurs and their very closest cousins. They link to unique features of the dinosaur foot skeleton, the digitigrade setup in which only the toes make contact with the ground when walking, the very narrow foot in which the metatarsals and toes are bunched together, the pathetically atrophied outer toes, the hinge-like joint between the toes and the metatarsals, which reflects the characteristic ankle of dinosaurs and birds, which can move only in a back-and-forth direction without even the slightest possibility of twisting. The Prorhodidactylus tracks were made by a bird-like archosaur very closely related to the dinosaurs. In scientific parlance, this makes Prorhodidactylus a dinosauromorph, a member of that group that includes dinosaurs and the handful of their very closest cousins, those few branches just below the bloom of dinosaurs on the family tree of life. After the evolution of the upright walking archosaurs from the sprawlers, the origin of dinosauromorphs was the next big evolutionary event. Not only did these dinosauromorphs stand proudly on their erect limbs, but also they had long tails, big leg muscles, and hips with extra bones connecting the legs to the trunk, all of which allowed them to move even faster and more efficiently than other upright walking archosaurs. As one of the first dinosauromorphs, Prorhodidactylus is something of a dinosaur version of Lucy, the famous fossil from Africa that belongs to a very human-like creature but is not quite a true human, a member of our species, Homo sapiens. In the same way that Lucy looks like us, Prorhodidactylus would have appeared and behaved very much like a dinosaur, but it's simply not considered a true dinosaur by convention. That's because scientists decided long ago that a dinosaur should be defined as any members belonging to that group, including the plant-eating iguanodon and the meat-eating megalosaurus, two of the first dinosaurs found by scientists in the 1820s, and all descendants of their common ancestor. Because Prorhodidactylus did not evolve from this common ancestor, but slightly before it, it is not a true dinosaur by definition. But that's just semantics. In Prorhodidactylus, we're looking at traces left behind by the type of animal that evolved into dinosaurs. It was about the size of a house cat, and would have been lucky to tip the scales at 10 pounds. It walked on all fours, leaving handprints and footprints. Its limbs must have been quite long, judging from the big gaps between successive prints of the same hands and feet. The legs must have been particularly long and skinny, because the footprints often are positioned in front of the handprints, a sign that its feet were overstepping its hands. The hands were small and would have been good at grabbing things, whereas the long, compressed feet were perfect for running. The Prorhodidactylus animal would have been gangly-looking, with the speed of a cheetah but the awkward proportions of a sloth. Perhaps not the type of animal you would expect the great Tyrannosaurus and Brontosaurus to ultimately evolve from. And it wasn't very common, either. Less than 5% of all the tracks found at Streisevicha belong to Prorhodidactylus, an indication that these proto-dinosaurs were not especially abundant or successful when they first arose. Instead, they were far outnumbered by small reptiles, amphibians, and even other types of primitive archosaurs. These rare, weird, not quite true dinosaur dinosauromorphs continued to evolve as the world healed in the early and middle Triassic. The Polish track sites, stacked orderly in time sequence like the pages of a novel, document it all. Sites like Wieri, Powingi, and Baranow yield an equally unfamiliar array of dinosauromorph tracks. Rhododactylus, Sphingopus, Perichirotherium, Atreopus, which diversify over time. More and more track types show up. They get larger. They develop a greater diversity of shape, some even losing their outer toes entirely so that the center toes are all that remain. Some of the trackways stop showing impressions of the hand. These dinosauromorphs were walking on only their hind legs. By about 246 million years ago, dinosauromorphs the size of wolves were racing around on two legs, grabbing prey with their clawed hands, acting a whole lot like a pint-sized version of a T-Rex. They weren't living only in Poland. Their footprints are also found in France and Germany and the southwestern United States, and their bones start showing up in eastern Africa and later Argentina and Brazil. Most of them ate meat, but some of them turned vegetarian. They moved quickly, grew fast, had high metabolisms, and were active, dynamic animals compared to the lethargic amphibians and reptiles they were cohabiting with. At some point, one of these primitive dinosauromorphs evolved into true dinosaurs. It was a radical change in name only. The boundary between non-dinosaurs and dinosaurs is fuzzy, even artificial, a byproduct of scientific convention. The same way that nothing really changes as you cross the border from Illinois into Indiana, there was no profound evolutionary leap as one of these dog-sized dinosauromorphs changed into another dog-sized dinosauromorph that was just over that dividing line on the family tree that denotes dinosaurs. This transition involved the development of only a few new features of the skeleton. A long scar on the upper arm that anchored muscles to move the arm in and out. Some tab-like flanges on the neck vertebrae that supported stronger muscles and ligaments, and an open window-like joint where the thigh bone meets the pelvis. These were minor changes, and to be honest, we don't really know what was driving them. But we know that the dinosauromorph-dinosaur transition wasn't a major evolutionary jump. A far bigger evolutionary event was the origin of the swift-running, strong-legged, fast-growing dinosauromorphs themselves. The first true dinosaurs arose sometime between 240 and 230 million years ago. The uncertainty reflects two problems that continue to cause me headaches, but are ripe to be solved by the next generation of paleontologists. First, the earliest dinosaurs are so similar to their dinosauromorph cousins that it is hard to tell their skeletons apart, never mind their footprints. For instance, the puzzling Nyasasaurus, known from part of an arm and a few vertebrae from approximately 240 million-year-old rocks in Tanzania, may be the world's oldest dinosaur. Or it may be just another dinosauromorph on the wrong side of the genealogical divide. The same is true of some of the Polish footprints, particularly the larger ones made by animals walking on their hind legs. Maybe some of these were made by real, true, honest-to-goodness dinosaurs. We just don't have a good way of telling apart the tracks of the earliest dinosaurs and their closest non-dinosaur relatives, because their foot skeletons are so similar. But maybe it doesn't matter too much, as the origin of true dinosaurs was much less important than the origin of dinosauromorphs. The other, much more glaring issue, is that many of the fossil-bearing rocks of the Triassic are very poorly dated, particularly those from the early to middle parts of the period. The best way to figure out the age of rocks is to use a process called radiometric dating, which compares the percentages of two different types of elements in the rock, say potassium and argon. It works like this. When a rock cools from a liquid into a solid, minerals form. These minerals are made up of certain elements, in our case including potassium. One isotope, atomic form of potassium, potassium-40, is not stable, but slowly undergoes a process called radioactive decay, in which it changes into argon-40 and expels a small amount of radiation, causing the beeps you'd hear on a Geiger counter. Beginning the moment a rock solidifies, its unstable potassium starts changing into argon. As this process continues, the accumulating argon gas becomes trapped inside the rock where it can be measured. We know from lab experiments the rate at which potassium-40 changes into argon-40. Knowing this rate, we can take a rock, measure the percentages of the two isotopes, and calculate how old the rock is. Radiometric dating revolutionized the field of geology in the middle of